politics had become a mess, as politicians and their constituents gave up seeking the common good to concentrate on seeking more goods for themselves and their friends. Rampant individualism was the rule of the day, and justice, if it was mentioned at all, was merely a pretext for self-seeking. This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, Director of Distance Learning at Wyoming Catholic College, and no, I'm not talking about the United States circa 2017, but about Athens in the days of Plato and Socrates, 400 years before the birth of Christ. Against that background of a decaying political culture, Plato wrote The Republic. In it, Socrates challenged the prevailing notions of justice and described what he viewed as true justice in individuals and in society. Dr. Virginia Arbery, Associate Professor of Humanities at Wyoming Catholic College, holds a doctorate in political philosophy from the University of Dallas. She has a great love for the Republic and has been teaching the book to our freshmen this spring. Armed with her and their insights, she's our guest today on the After Dinner Scholar. Welcome, Dr. Arbery. In the first chapter of The Republic, Socrates solicits answers to the question, what is justice? And proceeds to debunk every one of them. Yet the definitions are kind of hardy perennials, right? Mm-hmm. They're always there. Tell us about those ideas and Socrates' objections.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting, Jim, that Socrates doesn't really introduce the idea of justice. I love actually how the topic comes about. The old man who he is visiting under constraint, he's down in the Piraeus, which is the port of Athens, having been forced, in quotes, there by the son of the old man, Cephalus, who's a merchant. And Cephalus is sitting on a cushion with a wreath around his head, and the first thing Socrates says to him when he arrives in the room, which is arranged in a circle with other conversants, and he says to Cephalus, "Gosh, I haven't seen you in a long time, and you look so old." And then he proceeds to ask Cephalus, you know, what it's like to be old. And it's not exactly the most polite thing to say as a guest in the home of a rich man.
he says, I like to talk to people about road that I'm going to travel.
That's right. That's a road that I haven't gone down yet. So anyway, Cephalus then talks about how Sophocles was glad to be rid of the tyrant of lust, and that was one of the benefits of old age. And he says that is nothing that he mourns anymore or longs for, and that in fact he has a kind of peace. And his peace comes from, bringing up the term justice, from knowing that he has paid his debts and hasn't been a thief. He's done what he's supposed to in terms of his arrangements. And so his insistence that justice is a function of not having done anybody any wrong with what they own, with what they possess, prepares them then for the afterlife, for meeting the gods, or whatever the afterlife might mean. So Socrates begins to question this notion of justice and really puts poor Cephalus on the spot, who in the moment when he's just being made to look foolish decides he needs to go back to tend the sacrifices. And his son Polymarchus picks up the argument. Polymarchus insists that his father was right, that justice is, you know, being good to your friends and bad to your enemies. And once again, this argument turns out to be insufficient because sometimes you're not able to know the difference between your friends and your enemies. And not only that, if you follow the argument of Polymarchus's father, Cephalus, giving people what they possess, what they own, can sometimes be dangerous. You shouldn't give a madman a gun or a knife to hurt others. So this kind of disabusing his host and his son of their opinions makes the intellectual in the room, Thrasymachus, who's an out-of-towner, furious, and he jumps in like a beast, crouching and coming into his prey and furious at Socrates' methods, and insists that, come on, Socrates, justice is simply the right of the stronger. Well, by the end of book one, this beast Thrasymachus is blushing in shame because his argument is shown to be inconsistent, and he is aware that he's been shown to be inconsistent. And by the end of book one, we don't know what justice is. We just know that it isn't giving back to somebody what they own, or being good to your friends and bad to your enemies, or that it's the right of the stronger. So that's where it's left, and to be picked up later by two very important and interesting young men who are also in the room.
Let's pause a little bit on Thrasymachus's definition. Justice is nothing else than the interest of the stronger. Mm-hmm. If you have the power, you make the laws mm-hmm. to your advantage, and you force everybody to obey them. Mm-hmm. There's something very contemporary about that mm-hmm. sentiment, although no, certainly American politician would ever admit to it.
Indeed. I think you can say that it is reiterated shamelessly by Machiavelli in The Prince later in 1521. I mean, you have a whole tradition of political thought that is then ushered into what's understood as social contract theory by Hobbes as justice being the right of the stronger, untethered to what has traditionally been understood as the good or the virtuous. So justice is definitely exposed in all of its modern connotations early on in the Republic. In fact, I would say that there isn't an idea in politics that isn't already there in the Politeia, or the Republic, which means regime, which means constitution. The whole topic of justice drives the dialogue for a while, because the boys pick it up, Glaucon and Adeimantus, the older brothers of Plato, and they insist on wanting to hear what justice is for its own sake, not because it brings about rewards if you're just, or punishment if you're unjust, but what is justice on its own terms, for its own sake? So that drives the dialogue for a while, and then it goes in another direction.
Well, as opposed to the characters in the opening chapters, how does Socrates define justice?
He doesn't. I mean, he'll go so far as to say it's each man doing his own work, sticking with your own work. He tries to satisfy Glaucon and Adeimantus, the brothers, the definition by saying, look, I really can't show you justice because it's in the soul and it's hidden, so I need to blow up its meaning, or its letters, as he puts it, and show it to you in a way you can see it, which is in the city. So this is the direction the dialogue goes, from personal justice, personal accounts, to how we can see the just soul by looking at a city which is arranged properly. When we look at that city, then we find that the citizens or the subjects within it are assigned certain tasks, and they're assigned those tasks based on their suitability in their natures to perform those tasks. So one man, one job. And it looks as though that's the definition, as a kind of working definition for the sake of the argument, which is a bigger argument than justice, I would suggest. The way the argument goes is really toward something much larger and harder, even harder to understand than justice, which is the good. And that comes later in the dialogue.
Well, yeah, he talks about... he talks about how the unjust and the tyrannical, the most not good, are the most unhappy of people. Mm. And the just person is the happy person. Mm-hmm. Why is that?
Well, this is to answer Glaucon's depiction of the man who can get away with anything, the undetected, unjust man, who, using an old myth, the myth of Gyges, has a ring. The students always say, oh, it sounds like Frodo Baggins in the ring, in The Lord of the Rings. But he has this ring that he discovers and it provides him the powers of invisibility. And with these powers, he can go in the marketplace, steal, rob, he can take from his friends, he can have whatever woman he wants, this kind of thing, and go without suffering any punishment. And he even goes farther and says, this happy figure would appear to everybody else to be just, perfectly just. So the perfectly unjust man is appearing to be the perfectly just man. So Socrates has to answer this charge, this kind of depiction. Oh, and the other thing Glaucon suggests is that the perfectly just man is perceived by everybody as the perfectly unjust man. So he, kind of like Mel Gibson at the end of Braveheart, is tortured, his eyes gouged out, he's, you know, completely physically in pain and accused of being unjust when he's the perfectly unjust man. It's interesting. You can't help but think of the crucifixion of our Lord as this figure of unhappy but a just life. Well, Socrates spends the rest of the dialogue, it's a very important question you ask, trying to lead Glaucon, who has a hankering for power, who's spirited, and who would like the kind of benefits of being unjust without appearing to be so. He spends the rest of the dialogue moving Glaucon to the point where he will say, oh, the good, that must be the most pleasurable thing to apprehend, to be one with. And that's a longer process. I don't know if you want me to go there, but to get Glaucon to the point where he will see that goodness is the most pleasurable thing to be attained is the work of the dialogue, because it's the movement from the soul that wants a tyrannical life, that is to say, possession of whatever he desires, to a soul which is in love with the good for its own sake. And that's the real magic of the dialogue, I would say.
Well, we don't have time to go through the whole thing.
No.
But what can we learn from Plato as we look into our own contemporary political, let's call it our contemporary political situation?
One thing we can recognize, in especially as you go through Book 8 of the Republic, is how regimes which start out to be fairly good and unified around the ordering virtues of moderation, wisdom, courage, and justice, how those fairly good regimes can degenerate. And the account of degeneration of the regimes ends up in democracy, which in turn leads to tyranny. So a kind of clinical look at democracy, it always shocks students when they read it, because it's so contemporary. Plato, through Socrates, describes the son of a rich man. Oligarchy is the regime right before democracy, who is stung by what he calls unnecessary desires. He never can have enough. And those desires, in turn, lead him to look for things which he shouldn't have, and he's encouraged to do so. So he moves from one desire to another desire, and then he feels bad about it. So one day he's dieting, and the next day he's exercising, and then he's gorging himself the third day. So this mercurial figure that we recognize whenever we go through this supermarket and see the magazines about how to lose 30 pounds fast, or where to go to be on the most beautiful island on the ocean. You know, all these desires is what sting the democratic man. But there's a short step between that regime and the tyrannical soul, who, because he has these insatiable desires, will go into realms of injustice, so much as betraying his family, his friends, taking on to himself power simply for the sake of satisfying his ambition. And you can't help but think that that figure, who 9 times out of 10 is a demagogue, who gets to be the tyrant because he appeals to the desires of the many, is echoed in some way in our own political history. I don't want to offend Trumpites or FDR lovers or any other figures that have been very successful in persuading the many of their virtues, but there are certain echoes of the populist demagogue tyrant that I think we see in American politics.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
The Catechism of the Catholic Church teaches that justice is not something extrinsic, something out there, but that justice is a virtue and, quote, a virtue is a habitual and firm disposition to do the good, close quote. Plato knew, as the Church knows, that a society can only be just insofar as its citizens, that is, you and I, develop the habitual and firm disposition to act with justice. You've been listening to the After Dinner Scholar. If you've been enjoying these podcasts, please rate us on iTunes. And if you haven't subscribed yet, take the time to do that as well. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tunkowicz.